Mr. Pivovar, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Before you begin, do you have any questions?
I do not.
And Ms. Faust, do you have any questions? Mr. Pivovar, therefore, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Pivovar, and I represent the defendant here, Sarah Cohen. Sarah Cohen was convicted in 2014 of child abuse causing a death. She appealed the case. She was represented initially in the case by a private attorney, Joseph Howard. Joseph worked the case very well, very hard. He conducted a search for expert. He had used a particular expert before out of Cincinnati, Ohio, and Kim Hart. And so he contacted her, and she's an expert in the area of these kinds of cases, especially shaken baby type cases. At some point, Joseph became convinced that there wasn't enough money contained within the family to support what needed to be done in the case. Ms. Hart had indicated to him that there needed to be many, but at least two or three different kinds of experts engaged, and that those would be costly. They're people she had used from across the country, not necessarily here in Nebraska. At that point, Mr. Howard believed that the best thing he could do for Sarah Cohen was to withdraw from the case and get the public defender appointed, who had at least some funds to pour into expert witnesses. He did do that. But when he did that, he was very thorough in giving the public defender everything he had assembled to that point. All the experts he had talked to, the experts that Kim had told him, she had talked to, an outline of, just a basic statement of what they would say. He also had investigated alternate theories of how the injury might have been caused. Sarah was interviewed over a period of 2 days for about 6 hours, I think, total. She had given some contradictory statements during the time of her interviews by police. The public defender's office was provided with all this information. At the time of trial, the public defender's office offered no witnesses, had not engaged any expert witnesses of any kind, had not investigated the case, had met with her 4 times, only one of which was outside the presence of being in some kind of hearing in the courtroom where they met with her afterwards, had not responded to 4 letters from her begging that they look into the possibility of experts, and had told her father, who sat in the public defender's office for hours and hours waiting to get to see the two attorneys that were trying this case, they told him, we're not going to invest money in an expert. Basically, your daughter's guilty. These experts, Kim Hart especially, Kim Hart was capable on her own of putting together the entire case. Her statement was, after meeting, she flew to Omaha, met with Sarah in jail. She reviewed all the medical reports in the case and reviewed what the medical reports of the state would show. And her opinion was that Sarah's version of the facts of how the injury happened was just as likely as the state's theories of how the injury had happened. Reminding the court of the injuries, there were two separate head injuries. One was dated at somewhere between 0 and 2 days from when they alleged the incident happened, and the other was 0 to 14 days. And they could tell this because they were in various stages of healing. Ms. Hart was convinced that was the case. And she was also convinced after watching the interviews of Sarah that an expert would need to be engaged regarding the techniques that were used in interviewing her that basically ended up with these three different statements, where it goes from one level of involvement to a second level to a third level of the baby fell out of the swing. Not only were there inconsistencies, according to Ms. Hart, in the medical testimony, but Joe Howard had uncovered some witnesses who thought that it was just as likely that one of the parents had caused the injury, especially the mother. He met clandestinely in a car wash, and one witness would only speak to him as they drove through the car wash, telling him that the mother was extremely volatile, especially so since the birth of the child, and that he thought she was a likely suspect. There were other factual witnesses that were provided to the public defender's office, but yet they chose not to.
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller Lerman. With the time available, would you kindly address the defendant's request to testify and whether or not she was advised of her right to testify?
The only thing in the record, Judge, is the colloquy between the court and the defendant's attorney. The defendant was never asked personally whether she wanted to testify. Her attorney spoke on her behalf. She was convinced that...
Was she present at that hearing?
She was. She was. She was described in trial as being somebody who was emotionless and everything. I don't know about expecting her to override her attorney and interject. This was a 19-year-old girl at the time. She wasn't, you know, she wasn't a seasoned veteran of the street. But yeah, Jack, she indicates that in her letters, which she did not retain copies of, unfortunately, that she specifically requested, because she had some issues. She had been with this child for about a month and a half, I think, at the time.
I beg your pardon. So let me try this. If this court were to make the assumption that counsel failed to advise the defendant of her right to testify, what would you recommend? What do you think the law would require this court to do?
Well, at this point, we're only here on the denial of an evidentiary hearing. I would expect this court to give her an evidentiary hearing on that issue for sure. The lack of experts, I think she deserves an evidentiary hearing. It's significantly factually set out that it requires at least an evidentiary hearing to look at the facts. I think her counsel will testify how they will testify about giving her right to counsel or explaining it to her, but she will testify as she will testify. We're not entitled to the contents of the public defender's file until we're granted an evidentiary hearing. So we weren't able to see if those letters actually existed and things of that nature, which would go to prove that she was denied her right to testify, which in a case of this nature, her testimony, I think a jury wants to hear from a person in a situation like this. They're not, you know, sometimes in certain kinds of cases, guilt is assumed from not testifying. And I think this may be one of those situations where that can happen. Well, I see I'm out of time. We would ask to reverse the decision of the court and grant an evidentiary hearing for Sarah Cohen.
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Stacey Faust. I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the Appalachian State of Nebraska. The district court properly dismissed Cohen's motion for post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing. We are here on layered ineffective assistance of counsel claims, except for the ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim that Cohen preserved on direct appeal, which was that her counsel was ineffective for failing to investigate and call an expert medical witness on her behalf. I will focus on that claim and a related layered claim involving counsel's alleged ineffectiveness for failing to investigate Cohen's defenses and advise her of her options, including alternate theories of the cause of the severity of the injuries. The state's position is the same as the district court's was, which is that Cohen failed to make sufficient allegations to warrant a hearing on these claims. I want to start with a little bit of the evidence from the trial record. In the words of Dr. Haney, Cash Bell's brain had essentially fallen apart. He had bleeding in and around all surfaces of his brain and actual injury to the brain itself, including torn blood vessels and bruising to both sides. The injury to his brain was global, meaning that it was everywhere, and 90% of his brain was permanently damaged because of the lack of oxygen to it. Because of that injury, Cash would have been immediately unwell, and the symptoms would have been noticeable and of concern. He also had not one but two skull fractures and multiple retinal hemorrhages that extended to the back of his eyes. And when questioned, Cohen could not get her story straight. She stated that Cash started the day acting normal, but then he was not breathing normal after he woke from his nap. Her story evolved the more she was confronted with the medical evidence until she settled on it was an accident. She slipped at the top of the stairs while carrying Cash and he fell onto the tile floor below. Cash began to sustain injuries starting day two while in her care, and he continued to sustain injuries for those approximate 7 weeks that she cared for him. Those injuries increased in severity until the days of the ones that resulted in his death. And I say all of that because that was the strongest evidence against Cohen, and the allegations in her post-conviction motion failed to sufficiently account for any of it. Naming a trial consultant, Kim Hart, who thought that the case was fully defensible, along with a list of named experts and their fields of expertise, as Cohen did in her motion, is not enough. To be granted a hearing, she had to specifically allege what each expert would have testified to and how the testimony would have affected the outcome of her trial. In other words, she needed to allege how that named expert's testimony would have contributed to her defense and how it would have refuted the state's case against her. Her allegation that her statement that it was an accident down the stairs can explain Cash's second, can't help to explain Cash's second skull fracture either, not only for the lack of allegations I spoke about, but because it doesn't speak as to the rest of his injuries, most notably the brain injury that was the most serious of all of his injuries. She does attempt in her motion to pass blame to Cash's parents, Chris and Ashley, for Cash's brain injury, but that claim fails for so many reasons, not the least of which is pure speculation. It's a giant leap from Chris coming home for a minute to grab his checkbook and Ashley allegedly assaulting a coworker once to Chris or Ashley slammed and shook their own child, infant child, to death.
I beg your pardon. Can I ask you a question or two with respect to the allegation by the defendant that she was not advised of her right to testify and what the record shows and so forth?
Sure. It's the state's position that that claim is affirmatively refuted by the record because prior to closing statements, the court and trial counsel had the following exchange about whether Cohen would testify, And the court asked counsel, you have had sufficient conversation with your client about she could testify if she chose to. And counsel says, yes, we have. And the court says she's chosen not to. And counsel says, correct. And as counsel admitted today, Colin was standing right there and did not speak up and correct that if that was an incorrect representation of what her and her counsel had spoken about.
Is that the kind of colloquy that we would normally endorse as adequate?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. I mean, alternatively.
We would.
I mean,
shouldn't the defendant have been involved in the colloquy?
It's my position she was when she was standing there and stood silent as her counsel answered on her behalf.
Did the colloquy address the consequences of testifying and the consequences of not testifying?
No. But as I understand the claim, it was just, did counsel speak with you about your right to testify? And he answered in front of her to the court and represented as an officer of the court that yes, we did. And she's chosen not to.
So I beg your pardon. So the strongest thing in the record would be this colloquy that appears in the Bill of Exception at 1658, which is quoted in your brief. Right, that the judge talks to defense counsel, who says she's heard about it. That's it, right?
That's right. That's okay. It.
Okay. Yes. But if, for example, this court were to even assume that she was not advised by her counsel, a duty of counsel, where would that go? Well, if we were to assume she had not been advised of her right to testify. Is that a structural error?
No, I don't believe it's structural error. Alternatively, I think she still has to make, for assuming it's not structural error, she has to make sufficient allegations of prejudice in her post-conviction motion still, which she hasn't done. She has to say, what would you have actually testified about? And what she alleges in her motion was that she wanted to explain how the incident happened. Well, I guess if it actually happened some way other than her 4 previous statements to law enforcement, then she hasn't said what that is. And she also tested or asserted in her motion that she would have testified about how much she loved Cash. Well, that's not a sufficient allegation of prejudice. It's not going to result in a different outcome considering the evidence.
Let me, with the time we have, and I beg your pardon, let me try the framework a little further here. So if the failure of a lawyer to advise a client on right to testify, if it happened, and if it were structural, would prejudice be presumed in a direct appeal, but not in this case, which is post-conviction?
You're correct. And I think you're referring to the case of Weaver versus Massachusetts.
I think so that might be our framework. Thank you.
Yes. Yes. And so you would have to still do the Strickland analysis here. In order to do the Strickland analysis, I think that falls back again to what were her allegations of prejudice. And her prejudice allegations are not sufficient. I don't have, I will submit on the rest of on my brief for the rest of the claims, unless this court has any further questions. We ask you from the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Mr. Pivovar, were you appointed in this matter?
I was.
Thank you for your service. Counsel, you're excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Buckman. Justice Breidenberg is recused in this case, and I am recused in this case. So please give me a moment to exit the courtroom, and Justice Cassidy, I believe, will preside.